I'm David Halpin. I'm a retired surgeon, and I'm happy to speak to you, Tony.
Now, we've been looking at recently, in fact, in the last interview, we touched on it, David, this whole idea of nuclear power, because even though the Green Party and the Greens generally don't necessarily say that they want nuclear power, so they're not advocating for it per se. For example, the Scottish Greens are now advocating for the extension of the design life of reactors in Scotland. They think it's a good idea to extend the life of a reactor despite what it's been designed for. And we have a major problem with our energy in that most of the wind power and the solar power, you need more energy in the winter time. In many, many occasions over the winter, you're in a situation where solar and wind are delivering virtually nothing.
I know
so
that.
You've got to have some kind of base load which will pick up when these, you know, should we say, renewable, sustainable types of energy, the wind and the solar, aren't there. So anyway, can you just give us your take on nuclear power generally and its role, and I suppose it's, you know, its role now, and its safety as well, because this is really important. Something that people forget is that nuclear reactions are incredibly dangerous things. And for example, fuel rods, if you're transporting them, I remember being told by the nuclear engineer John Large before he died,
oh, really? Yeah, sure.
That if you were to run on a playing field which a nuclear fuel rod was just lying there and try and jump over it, you would be dead before you got to it. So anyway, that's how toxic these things are. So anyway, could you just give us your take on nuclear power, please?
Well, briefly, it's a scam. And first of all, there's a little logic in it. The isotopes that are generated in nuclear power generation cannot be disposed of safely. When they come to the end of their life, there are vast costs of decommissioning, which we, the taxpayers, are probably funding, but the whole thing is silent. What really made me think harder about nuclear power, I knew it wasn't a good source of energy, partly because of the waste isotopes, but the story we discussed last time of Windscale, where the scene is in charge that day when the pile went out of control, they said they were cutting corners to produce plutonium for the US. That, I think, is a key fact.
Well, this is, just to put this in context, this is the time of the so-called missile gap, where the Russians, which at the time the Soviet Union, were building missiles, nuclear ballistic missiles, at a rate much faster than the Americans. The Americans were running scared, apparently.
I didn't know that, but I can see why there was some urgency in producing more plutonium. But it underlines the fact that nuclear power feeds nuclear weapons. It's key. It produces the plutonium, which is used, you know, in atomic and hydrogen bombs. I think hydrogen bombs as well, as far as I know. So that, but what I've been thinking about, Tony, is the psychology of it. If there was a move to produce a nuclear weapon, say in the 1930s, both in Europe and in America, what sort of mind was driving it? When you read the stories of the Maud Report and the basis of the nuclear bomb being taken from this country during the Second World War to America, you look at the people involved, and they're a very odd lot. I think I have a lot of interest in the neutron weapon, the enhanced radiation weapon, because I'm absolutely certain it was used by the coalition of the willing, and especially by the Americans and possibly by the British as well, in Iraq during the shock and awing. I'm absolutely certain of that. And I think they used neutron weapons before. But the fellow who designed the neutron weapon was a man called Cohen. I forget his first name. But he described it as a humanitarian weapon. And you know the effect of the neutron bomb, the enhanced radiation weapon, is it destroys tissue, but not material. But this, you look at the psychology of people like this and you realise they are extraordinary and probably psychopathic.
Well, look, the trouble is, of course, the argument from the weapons manufacturers is if we don't do it, the other side will.
No, well, that comes down to MAD, mutually assured destruction. And it is an illogical, pathological policy.
Well, I don't think the North Koreans, Kim Jong-il, would agree with you. He's saying, well, actually, now we've got nuclear weapons, the Americans are really afraid of us. They're not coming here.
Well, I'm not discussing the psychopathology of Kim Jong-il, but probably he's a psychopath as well. The thing is that what motivates people to design and manufacture and plan for the use of weapons that destroy thousands in a stroke?
Well, and the answer to that is the Pacific War in 1945, isn't it?
It is. It is. But that was all about signalling to the Russians, stay back. The Sakhalin Islands, as far as I know, they got as far as that. And they wanted to stop further Russian ingression into Japan, I understand. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. The Russians were preparing to invade Japan. And, of course, this was a signal from the Americans to stop them doing that and make sure that the Japanese were going to have a relationship with the United States rather than Russia.
Right. But I'm digressing. But if you look on my website, Halpin Surgeon, you'll find if you put in a grotesque hypocrisy, it's about the Holocaust Day Memorial. And I wrote to the people who run this. It's costing us $500,000 a year in public funding to run this HDM, as it's called. But I wrote about the way they excluded the Holocaust of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, of the 20 million North American Indians who were eliminated, mostly by rifle, but also by smallpox in blankets. I think about the Aborigines, where our lot went out on a Sunday to shoot them. I think of Holocaust like that. And I don't believe that you should single out one Holocaust, although it was massive, against especially the Jews, but also the Roma and the Communists. And it also included, I understand now, Soviet prisoners of war. If you look at Bibi Yar in Ukraine, there were some hundreds, in fact several thousands, of Russian prisoners of war that they executed as well, apparently.
Yeah, and the disabled people, for example, too. Slavs were completely demonised as well. But anyway, back to nuclear power. We are giving up on the idea of using fossil fuels, whether that's oil or gas or coal.
Yeah.
So really, nuclear is the only option.
Right. But what I'm focusing on, Tony, is the image. If that image of that column of atomised land, Christmas Island, in the case of Britain, I understand our H-bomb was the biggest, I'm told, the biggest bang, and they wanted that. But when you look at that column ascending rapidly into that mushroom cloud, going ever higher and taking those isotopes, sometimes with massively long half-lives, all round the stratosphere, right round the world, you know that is essential evil. And there's an image which is a little bit like it, the genie, you know, with the tail down to the bottom, and at the top, this rather awful fasces, you know, looking evil. But you see, what I'm thinking about is the people who are conceiving the nuclear explosion and eventually going on to produce the bomb, and eventually, you know, with Big Boy, whatever it was called, dropping it on a dense city like Hiroshima to fry people and to leave them with cancers for the next 40 or 50 years. What is their mind like? And I suspect that image of the mushroom cloud is right in the middle of their psyche.
Round about 2010, I noticed that the Royal British Legion put out a statement where they had I guess it was their annual meeting from all the British Legion clubs around the country, a statement saying, for many years we've said war is inevitable. We've now changed our mind. We think actually war is not inevitable. And so this was quite a big policy statement from the British Legion. But then they changed their mind back again. They got rid of that from their... they've completely changed now, by the way. They've become kind of corporate. Their magazine...
No surprise.
Doing these kind of publicity stunts, yes. Like round the Tower of London, yes. For example. And they've turned themselves into almost like a kind of marketing machine, yes. For war.
Yes.
But, I mean, you know, obviously they're saying this is for soldiers who have fallen in Afghanistan now and things like this. So they've also changed from fighting Hitler and evil into our colonial wars of various sorts. So anyway, so on the aspect, all these aspects of modern understanding of war, one of the greatest British politicians, orators on the subject, and I used to listen to him from my squat in Bristol back in the, I suppose, be 2005 or something, talking about the invasion of Iraq and talking about the aftermath of it, just taking the British public on BBC Radio 4 Today programme, sometimes, by the way, rinsing American people who are on at the same time American warmongers, I suppose disposing of them in verbally. And it was very sad when he died. A lot of people at the time said that was a very convenient
who
death.
Who was that?
Robin Cook.
Oh, Cook. Yes.
A lot of people at the time said it was a very convenient death. It was, as far as I recollect, the circumstances were he was walking with his wife on Ben Stack, which is somewhere not too far away from Glasgow, west of Glasgow somewhere, and west and north. And he had some sort of heart problem, phoned for a doctor to say, what should we do? Any advice? And they said, oh, just by coincidence, there is a exercise going on nearby. We have a helicopter which can come and pick you up. They've got some medics on board and they can take you to hospital. So the helicopter came over to Robin. He was taken into the helicopter. His wife, Gaynor, tried to get into the helicopter, was told, no, you can't come too, which she was a bit perturbed about. So she was left alone on the mountainside. Apparently there may have been some other walker with them. But anyway, we were then told, oh, poor Robin Cook is no more. So anyway, I wonder what you make of this, because I know you've got some contacts in the medical profession that know a little bit about what happened that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've come into contact with a man who was his GP, and he didn't have a heart problem. I think he had some hypertension, which is quite common, and he was leading a very pressurised life, so I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't have a rather...
Let's also remind people that he had resigned from being Shadow Foreign Secretary, yes. Hadn't he?
Yes, he'd resigned during the lead-up, in the few days before we invaded Iraq. But this man was his GP, and he was very disturbed when he heard that he died of a cardiac condition, because as far as he knew, as far as he had determined, he did not think that he had a sick heart. And the circumstances surrounding it, like, for instance, the fact that Gaynor did not accompany her dying or her husband being undergoing cardiac massage, is extraordinary. And the whole thing was all rather quick, wasn't it? Rather like the death of Smith before that.
Well, that's right. This is John Smith, the Labour leader, who also died of a heart attack, supposedly.
But what I'd like to say, Tony, I'm going to go back a bit, about the nuclear weapons. There is also that part of the human psyche that loves destruction, and Samson-like is happy to pull the pillars down around them. And the Armageddonists, as I call them, like the idea of global explosion. There's something about it. I don't know why it is in them. They're life-denying in life. These people do the most awful things, as they're doing in Palestine now. Terrible. You know, thousands of crimes committed every day in that country. And we were doing the similar things in Iraq ourselves, our own country. But these people are extraordinary. They are life-denying, and they like the idea of massive destruction.
Well, getting back to John Smith or Robin Cook, there are technologies out there, as I understand it, that can where you can remotely mess around with someone's heart rhythms.
Yes, I understand that, actually. I don't know how they do it, but there is a way of producing I don't know how it's done, but I know it can happen. But when you think also of one those people, there's a good example of Mahbub, who was, I think, a Hamas high command fellow, who was killed by the Israelis in Dubai. And they had 16 people involved in it. They used the calabar bean, physostigmine, which leaves no trace in the body. But there was a very good senior copper in Dubai who went into it all. And do you remember that, Tony? There were 9 cloned British passports. Do you remember that? 9. Did anything happen between Britain and Israel following that? Not on your Nelly was a reaction to that. But just think, that's what they had to do. For Kelly, it was also a rather elaborate exercise too. We could discuss the possibilities there on another occasion.
Well, before we get off the subject of heart attacks, because of course it's quite a good way to kill somebody if you can induce a heart attack, we should talk about the case of the hacker who he discovered that you could hack into pacemakers and actually kill people using their pacemaker.
I can imagine that very easily. I can imagine that so easily. I haven't thought of it before, but I can see that so easily. But how you disturb heart rhythm by some external physical means, I don't know about. But I've heard that theory, that hypothesis, because it's happened. And I'm thinking now of those presidents in Africa, and I'm thinking of the one from, is it Tanzania, who was in April of 2020, in a rather jokey way. He was, in fact, he was smiling when he spoke about it. But he said he'd put the ruddy swab for the PCR test into a pawpaw and into some engine oil. I remember that as well. And it turned up positive. It turned up positive. And he's no longer with us, is he? He died of a heart attack.
That's right.
And there's about 4 other senior African leaders who apparently also spoke about the COVID scam, who also are no longer with us. I don't know all the details, but certainly the Tanzanian leader, his death was questioned in its natural cause.
Yeah, so I think one of the specific things about the pacemaker, you know, killing somebody by remote control, almost like, you know, on your mobile phone or on your computer. Yeah. We've connected up to the pacemaker now. Let's kill them. This was known about, and the reason we know that it's so serious is that the hacker who was about to give a presentation about hacking pacemakers and how to kill people himself died, even though he was a young man, just before the presentation, mysteriously.
I don't know about that. Was he British?
I think he was Canadian. We'll just have to check the name, etc. But even more importantly, in a way, Dick Cheney, who had a pacemaker, had a very special pacemaker, which had any kind of ability to connect with it remotely, removed.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I keep saying, there is no depth which the psychopath will not sink. And I think of Blair when I say that.
From nuclear power to induced heart attacks as a form of assassination. David Halpin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.